open. What we do, we will go into a more formal ceremony as soon as, I mean, committee hearing, as soon as we have a quorum, but right now we want to get started with the hearing. So you can have your complete hour and a half because we've been starting a little behind time. So we're going to be hearing House Bill 5031. Ms. Baker will bring us up to date, but we'd like to have Ms. Foley and whomever else she chooses to bring up to the podium. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to reiterate House Bill 5031 is still before you today. This piece is the children, adults, and families piece, and this week we will focus on the child welfare program. So similar to last week, we'll expect to have 3 days of testimony from the agency and then on Thursday have public testimony on this part of the budget.
A lot of this this presentation also will deal, I think the Child Protective Services piece are in this, and so committee members, should you have any questions whatsoever, may I encourage you, as we've done in the past, to be able to get those to Ms. Baker so we can have, they can anticipate, they can actually know what you would anticipate to happen in terms of questions that you might have that they cannot answer right on the spot. So I appreciate your further help in doing that. Any comments before we get started? Either the senators, members of the House. Thank you. And I'd like to thank Ms. Boone for taking over the last two Thursdays when I've had to be in Portland. So thank you very much. It's a pleasure. Ms. Foley.
Chair Carter, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director at the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. Today we begin discussing child welfare, and we will spend today talking about child protective services. Tomorrow we'll talk about out-of-home care, also known as foster care, and then Wednesday we hope to finish up with adoptions. We will, on the 28th, have the field presentation around children, adults, and families, and at that point we'll be talking about two of the larger policy option packages that we are bringing forth in the governor's recommended budget. On page 85, you will see just the kind of the overview. The key programs, as you know, are founded in statute here in Oregon. Department does have the authority to deliver child protective services and foster care and adoptions. And we've given you some sites there of where that is in the statute. And in the first chart you see there, you'll see the governor's recommended budget for child welfare is $414.5 million, or 16.4% of CAF's budget. So while it is about 16% of CAF's budget, many of you know from your constituent calls, it garners about 90% of the constituent concerns and media attention around child welfare. It's a very emotional kind of program. Seldom do decisions get made that don't generate some controversy because there's always multiple parties involved when we're talking about child welfare services. Some folks think we intrude too much, others think we don't intrude enough, and that's kind of part of what child welfare is about in the public sector. So you see there, a lot of the funding in child welfare goes to substitute care or out-of-home care, and you will see on that same chart, the smaller amount goes to child safety. And then there's adoptions, and adoptions includes adoption assistance, so that's why it's a large piece of the pie. But the thing I think is interesting about this is child safety doesn't garner as many federal funds as foster care. And that's kind of a dilemma in the system in this country, because it's easier to get a child into foster care and get those federal dollars flowing than it is to try to serve children in home. And so that's always a challenge for us, and one that we will continue to talk about as we discuss child protective services. The next two pages you see.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
Can you profile for me, when you say substitute care, out-of-home care, profile what that's like?
Chair Carter, that means any child who has to be removed from their family because of a child protective services issue. Very few voluntary placements, maybe a handful, but mostly that covers any child who's residing in out-of-home care, the child's in agency custody, and the child has to be in a licensed or certified providers, either a foster family home, residential treatment, group home, or so forth. And we'll talk about those various different kinds of foster care when we do that piece tomorrow. The next two pages you see are just continued pie charts showing kind of what the budget is when you break that budget down. Again, you'll see in child welfare, 62% of that budget being federal funds. And then the last chart there, you will see of the federal funds, a large portion of those federal funds are Title IV-E. You will hear more about Title IV-E. IV-E basically means the funding that's available through the federal government for a child who comes into foster care. If the child would have been eligible for TANF or AFDC at the time the child was removed from the home. And so the federal government only participates in a certain portion, about 60% of the children who come into foster care. That will become important later when we talk about relative foster care, because in our state, if the child is 4E eligible, then the relative receives a board payment for the child. If the child is not 4E eligible, then the state has a public policy and a statute that doesn't allow us to pay that relative. So that is one of the policy option packages we'll be talking about tomorrow, is the relative foster care.
So when you come with that one on tomorrow, would you make the distinction, because a lot of my phone calls come from grandparents or close relative, like an aunt, who themselves have a good income, but yet the state will not help support the child. So is 4E, you said?
4E is the funding source chair card for children to receive that board payment. And Oregon is unique in that we don't pay those relatives if the child isn't 4E eligible. In other states, it's paid out of general fund. And so that's one of the pieces we'll present tomorrow when we talk about that policy option.
Appreciate it. So, members, if there are any questions along those lines, because I know I personally get a lot of calls on that piece. So if there are questions, again, get them to the speaker or call Ramona's office so she can address those tomorrow when she's not on that piece. Thanks again.
Thank you. You have two handouts before you that are called the National Resource Center for Child Protective Services Update on Recommendations and the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement. And I wanted to mention these to you before we actually start on the presentation, because these have garnered a lot of attention. There have been newspaper articles about these, and these have been sort of a blueprint for what we've been doing since the last session. As many of you recall, we had a couple of high-profile cases here in the state in the winter of 2005. And the result of that was the governor asked a group of national experts, to come into Oregon, take a look at our child safety system in the department, and make recommendations of how we might make improvements, systemic improvements across our department. And the experts testified in a legislative committee in May of 2005. And this list of things you see, the recommendations and the status, I won't talk about all of those, but those are things we have been diligent about taking care of during this last year and a half. And the reason that's important is not only do these things lead us to the policy option packages that we'll be discussing, but they also lead us to where we are in terms of the critical issue around workload and around staffing in child welfare. You see, the first recommendation was that we should have a safety framework, one that's very precise about how we intervene with families, when we do and when we don't, and also that's consistent across the state. One of the findings was that we had some very good practice, but it was sporadic in terms of each county sort of having to figure out on its own how it was going to do some of the precision around child safety. And some of you have seen that when you look at our data from across the state, you'll see wide variation in who gets an assessment or who gets a screened out call. And so we're moving towards more consistency and more precision with all of this work. Item two there, you'll see they recommended we have a procedure manual. And what this is going to enable us to do is have caseworkers who don't...
Excuse me for a minute, Senator Bates.
A question?
Yes, please.
Ramona, could you give us a copy of the safety intervention model for us to read through later?
Chair Carter and Senator Bates will be happy to.
Thank you.
Just a minute. Senator Wesson.
Thank you. Just a comment. And what I see in your number one here, adopt a safety framework, statewide consistency and oversight and evidence-based practices, I think, has larger application to many of the services DHS and indeed the private medical community outlines. And I see this as no different, Ramona, and I very much appreciate this recommendation and this work because it's, you know, it's kind of, we know what to do. We just need to make sure that's done consistently everywhere and do that better.
Chair Cardin, Senator Weston, thank you very much for that. And that really has been the focus of our work, is to try to get consistency and best practice in getting that consistency.
Ramona, we also, I see where you're saying that you had some resource limitations, and that should be brought to the legislature. It should be on record what you need, even if the legislature doesn't fund it.
Chair Cardin, we'll be happy to do that. An example of that, the national expert said that in the best of all models, when you have a child protective services phone call that comes in, you make face-to-face contact within 24 hours to assure that the child is safe. And in our state, our policy right now is we have criteria that require the 24-hour contact, but we also have a set of cases that will require up to a 5-day contact because of the resource issue. The 5-day contact means the perpetrator doesn't have direct access to the victim child, according to the report. But there are several standards like that that we can't get quite to where we want to be, but we want to continue to bring those to your attention because those are part of what we think would be a best practice system.
Good. Just for a moment, please. I'd like to welcome SEIU folk with us here today. Hope that you enjoy your stay in this hearing room today. We're dealing with human services issues and dealing right now with child, adult, and other families' issues with the Department of Human Resources testifying before us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jeff. Item 2 is the procedure manual. I think this is going to be a tremendous tool for our caseworkers. Our caseworkers have struggled by trying to interpret law and interpret the rules and the policies, and it's fairly complex, as you can imagine, in something as intrusive as child protective services. So we are producing a 10-chapter document that will be their procedure manual, and it will give them step-by-step direction on how to handle situations. Anything from that first phone call coming in all the way through to finalization of an adoption or the child's successful return home. We also had to revise all of our rules that are attached to child welfare, and so we had 400 pages of rules rewritten and new rules put out for public comment. Public comment period ended January 31st, and so right now we're finalizing some of the changes made as a result of public comment, and those will be found in the new procedure manual. This required training. We did conceptual training with the national experts here for 1,800 of our staff this past fall to make sure everybody understood the concepts in this new model that we are moving to in March. Legal representation, we will talk later about a policy package. We continue to struggle, and the National Resource Center identified that this is an area of concern because our staff traditionally have had to handle their own legal work when they go to court on cases, and some of you have heard us talk about this in the past. During the interim, we were able to get some relief on this, and we hired some paralegal staff and some additional attorneys, but it's just a small piece for what we need to move to, because these cases are so significant when you talk about taking somebody's child away from them and whether or not they ever get their child back. We really do need to have legal counsel with us to look at legal sufficiency around that case. Was that an appropriate decision? And so we will be talking more about an additional package to try to give more legal assistance to caseworkers so they can spend their time doing social work and not having to perform as attorneys.
Is that in the policy option package?
Yes, Chair Carter, it is. There's one on legal representation.
Okay.
SACWIS is our automated system. I will just mention it only because it came out of the report, and we do have work well underway over the past 2 years towards a new SACWIS system, and that's scheduled for completion in April of 2009. In legislation, there are several pieces that I won't go into the details here, but several pieces of legislation came out as a result of the national experts looking at our system, where they said there are some things that are unique about Oregon, but it may not be driving you to the best place. And so some of those are finding their way through other committees, even as we speak, in terms of some making some changes in the system, including the statutes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bates.
This is really a question for you more than her.
Okay.
you know, from a point of view of a caseworker, I know this is a terribly difficult job. There's a lot of burnout involved in it. I'd be interested to know what that number actually is, how long an average caseworker can stay in this position. And a lot of it involves around the restrictions on them or the requirements of them by state law. Will we be seeing those in this committee, or is this going to be kind of all over the legislature here? I mean, I'd like to see one place we kind of bring it together and say...
Well, I know the budget piece will be coming to us because we do have a policy option package where they're asking for increased numbers of legal...
We expect that. We discussed the last time,
right.
Last session.
Could you... Well, I tell you what we'll do. We'll spend some time looking at the legislation that they have so that we can be much more acquainted with it. But it would probably go to substantive committee.
I would guess so, but yeah. It has significant, potentially significant mm-hmm. financial aspects
to it.
I'd like to know if our policies and our laws are moving us in a direction we can be more effective, have best practices, and then support it financially. I know this is an area of real difficulty for the agency.
Okay. That's going to be a challenge because some of that has already come up in the budget committee in terms of whether we can afford to have more legal representation when indeed the recommendations come from the national group in terms of saying that we can better use the time of the social worker to do social work instead of trying to do social work and legal representation, which sometimes does not benefit the state, by the way.
Or the child.
Absolutely, the child.
And there's questions of whether or not they should even legally be doing this. They
right.
might be themselves at risk that they aren't doing things they're not supposed to be doing. They're forced to because somebody has to do it.
Now, what this is a mistake, but answer this question. How many other states use their social workers to do some of the legal work our social workers do here?
Sure, Carter. To our knowledge, no other state allows the caseworker to go into court and present the case on behalf of the agency. States use attorneys for that. There are a few jurisdictions around the country where if the child is in permanent foster care, the court may not require an attorney to come in with the caseworker because the case has reached a status of almost closed. But we're the only state that routinely allows our workers to go into court and to try to cross-examine witnesses or to challenge attorneys for the parent, attorneys for the child. And so it's a really unique situation we find ourselves in.
That's actually a scary situation. Let the speaker explain one thing, then we'll come to Senator Gordley.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to suggest maybe I will work with the agency to get a list of the legislation and maybe highlight those that could be expected to come to Ways and Means after they get to the policy committee so you can be aware of those.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The policy that we're referencing, which is our current policy or practice, is unacceptable. But my question goes to the governor's policy option package and how we might be looking at that same package as a committee. Is the amount in the governor's recommendation sufficient? Is it a sufficient investment to move us forward and away from a practice that's unacceptable?
Chair Carter, that would be no and yes, or yes and no. Let me explain. It does move us in a direction where there's more legal representation. It does not achieve an ultimate goal of always having an attorney do the legal work involved in a case. What that package is going to do, and that package comes about with the detail as a result of a committee that the Attorney General chaired, and that committee came out with a recommendation. And what that package ultimately will do is it would allow to have an attorney staff a case with the worker at the fifth month that the child was in foster care, and again at the 11th month, because those are critical points in cases in which decisions are being made as to whether or not children are ever going to return home or whether or not we're going to be moving towards another permanency outcome such as adoption. So that's what the policy package actually does. And so it does move us to a better place, but it's also important to know that it does not mean that we would not have workers going to court without having an attorney with them, because they'll still be doing that under the policy package.
Senator, we're going to thoroughly discuss the policy packages so that we can come back to that. And I think the question that begs to be answered here today, well, we can't answer today, but when this policy package does come up, will the legislature be able to even fund at the level the governor has recommended? So you'll be answering a question even down from where the governor's piece is in the future. Senator Gordon, I'll let you complete, and then Senator Westland, we'll let you complete. Okay.
Well, there's so many ways to respond to what I'm hearing, and I guess I'll just say this one piece for now. We need to make investments that are sustainable. Mm-hmm. And again, when we're talking about our children and our families and building supports for them that make sense, that are meaningful, we need to be looking at how we do that sustainably. And we can't do it. We can't get there. And unless we're willing to have the conversation about revenue reform in this building. And so it's my hope that we have that conversation. It's still early in the session. It's still February. That we find our way to having that conversation about revenue reform, which will then inform where we can make sustainable investments that will build on the future, the kind of future that many of us want to see for our families and for our state. I'll return to the soapbox later, but that's my piece for now.
We will be discussing that in depth at the close of this, the content part, the substantive part of the bill itself. Senator Westland?
Well, I mean, if Senator Gordley is temporarily going to step off the revenue reform soapbox, I am certainly going to jump on it. We go through this discussion in every Ways and Means hearing room, every session, mm-hmm. about not just the adequacy, which we immediately focus on here, and we do not spend enough time on the equally fundamental component of revenue, the stability mm-hmm. of it, to fund these vital public services. And one thing that is always interesting to me, and I understand, you know, the immediate and pressing need takes a higher priority. But until we just stop dancing around on the head of the immediate pin to fund this now today, we will never be able to adequately fund public services in the state of Oregon until we and all of us in this state have the courage to address what is documentably the most volatile revenue structure in the country. The 2001-03 recession and the draconian budget cuts we made are guaranteed to happen again. Unless we have the courage and exhibit the political will to change an antiquated revenue structure. Mm-hmm. Now I'll step off that soapbox and say, Ramon, I appreciate very much you bringing me and the committee's focus on, you know, one of the requirements of our caseworkers. But let's not lose sight of the fact, and this is a revenue issue, let's not lose sight of the fact that the caseloads, these very difficult, ever more complicated caseloads, are increasing much faster than staff's ability to continue to provide the necessary services. It's just not legal representations. You know, it's the staff's ability to deal with an increasing workload. So as we look at the legal side and that narrow component of the broad responsibilities, we can't lose sight of the other important work that's done.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cortez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to echo what Senator Bates, I believe, was mentioning about getting a good handle on what we actually need in terms of resources to implement best practices. And I think the policy option packages are certainly a step forward. We'll argue legal representation is a good thing, but as yourself noted, it doesn't necessarily reduce workload. That caseworker still needs to be in court, although legal representation would be there. And it would be helpful for us to know, what are we trying to buy when we eventually fix the revenue system? How do we get to the adequate workload, not just the caseloads, but the workloads? And if you're able to provide some of that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, what we can do is come back with some figures where we did some comparisons of other states who have had to move to having legal representation in all of their cases as a result of a class action suit. Utah comes to mind. It was one of the settlement parts of the class action, and we'll bring those budget figures back about what that gold standard would be to have legal representation in all cases when the worker goes to court.
May I follow? That would be wonderful, but also just the regular, in addition to the legal representation point, but at the workload level, because we are going to see there's a lot of policy bills running around with best practices, and I'm hoping that people will pass those back to us so we can make the decision around money when they are actually the best policy. But I think that'll be challenging to see what we actually get out of the substantive committees. But
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, that is something you'll see in the policy option package around staffing for child welfare. We've looked at national standards and to see how we hold up against national standards. Item number 9, which is right below family meetings, speaks to that workload crisis that Wayne Holder identified in our state and said that it is just not possible for staff to carry the number of cases that they are carrying and be successful in the jobs we're asking them to do. And as a result of that, you see the second page is the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement. We had them come in this year, during 2006, just this past year, and their report came out in January. And we are using that report now to look at what workloads look like, not only at the casework level, but also at the supervisor level in child welfare. And that's part of the policy option packages that we'll be talking about when we talk about the CAFPO structure next week.
Thank you. Can we get a copy of that?
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, both of these are on the website. We can produce copies for you, but they are both out there on the DHS website, is my understanding.
Great, thank you.
Members, I want you to know that we are now funding DHS caseworkers at 1999-2001 levels.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I could clarify that, what the governor's budget does is bring them to the national standards that, depending on the position, were established in 1999 or 2001. So right now the caseload ratios are not even to those levels. Mm. And so I believe the Holder report, or the organizational improvement technical assistance report that is a companion to that, would argue that you need to further reduce the caseloads, but the governor's budget does move it forward at least to those somewhat antiquated national standards.
Wow. But that goes back to what Senator Gordley was saying a little earlier, that we have not raised revenue in the state in so long that the ratio to caseworkers and their heavy loads is just unbelievable, unimaginable. Thank you.
Chair Carter, with that, I think we're ready to move into Child Protective Services with that as a context for what we have been doing over the last year and a half.
Thank you.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for Children, Adults, and Families with the Department of Human Services. And today I will be covering the Child Protective Services budget and do a discussion of the practice and try to provide to you some critical data that we feel is important in giving you the story of our child safety intervention system. Ms. Foley talked about the budget for child safety. You saw how that child safety budget fit into the bigger picture. And what I will do first, just very briefly, is to talk about the contracted services within the child safety program area. This does not include staffing. I'd like to be sure that everyone understands that. So you'll see, you should have received a new page, and you'll see the Child Protective Services budget. And that budget includes 54% is family-based services, and I'll talk about those in just a moment. 20% is a community-based domestic violence services. We have 2% for family support teams, and I'll be referring to those as addiction recovery teams when I talk about those. We have 2%, which are mutual homes. We have 2% community-based sexual assault victims fund. And then we have 20% system of care flexible funds.
Mutual homes.
Pardon me?
What are mutual homes?
Chair Carter, members of the committee, the mutual homes are for recovering parents and children. We have just a few that we're able to offer in this state.
Thanks. Senator Bates.
Would that be like the dad's programs and mom's programs in Jackson County?
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, I will have to get back to you. I believe it is it's essentially a home that we pay for both the care of the parent. Sometimes the child is in our custody with the parent. And I'll certainly clarify if the one in Jackson County is the one that you're talking about. Yes. So I'll start with the addiction recovery teams, and those are identified as the family support teams in that budget document. And as you already know, substance abuse, particularly methamphetamine, tends to be a primary family stressor within our Child Protective Services assessments. And the addiction recovery teams are teams that include certified drug and alcohol counselors and outreach workers to work in child welfare offices with social service specialists to provide coordinated multidisciplinary services to families who are seeking drug and alcohol services. Those teams don't provide drug and alcohol treatment per se, but they are able to do some very limited scope evaluations, and they're able to transition those families through the time that they have to wait for services. The domestic violence and sexual assault funding are grants that are managed out of the Child Protective Services program area, and those are services for communities. They're identified grants to provide access in communities to appropriate domestic violence and sexual assault services, so communities have that capacity to serve those clients. They are not just child welfare clients that are served by those services. Then I'll move on to the family-based services.
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. May I ask a question about that one?
Right, please.
You mentioned that this is grants that go to communities. What kind of formula do you use for those?
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, could you clarify just a bit more for me?
Well, grants would say to me that someone would apply and you would determine whether it met the criteria, whether or how much you would fund the program. Is that correct?
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, yes, there is. There's essentially an RFP process in which providers are asked to offer certain kinds of services. They have to meet a certain criteria of services. Some of these grants we join with the Department of Justice on, and we try to determine the best the best formula for services to a community, but they do have to meet specific criteria in the grant.
Could I have a follow-up?
Yes, please.
Could you please talk for a moment about whether you fund all of the requests that come in, and if you don't, is it because they didn't meet the criteria, or you didn't have enough money to fund all the requests, or whether you fund some local requests? Like in one county, would you find yourself funding more per capita than in another county?
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson. I think I can answer that question, and if not, I'd be happy to bring you information later. There are specific contracts. There's a specific amount of money and specific criteria. They don't fund individual requests as they come in. There's a specific RFP process that takes place at a point in time, and those grants are RFP'd during at a scheduled time, and then communities can offer their services for that grant. Does that answer your committee, your question? I'm sorry.
Not exactly, but it may be too technical, so I can ask someone later. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Barad?
Senator, thank you, Senator Carter. Just a brief comment, being a former county commissioner, I know how sought after these grants are in the various counties, and they do wonderful things in our communities. But again, there's never enough to go around. So, thank you.
Okay. Chair Carter, Representative Gerard, I appreciate those comments, and that's absolutely true. The family-based services.
But maybe I can help a little, after listening to what you just said. So, Representative Nathanson's question was, how do you decide, is there a formula, since we have 36 counties, how do you determine what county is going to get how much of the money that comes in each of the grants that you get? Is that your question?
Okay. Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson and Representative Gerard, the group that the board that oversees these grants has just recently gone through quite a process of determining a weighing criteria, a formula to use, trying to determine how they would determine each community got funding, and I would be happy to get you a memo on that. I'd like to let you know that they took into account a number of different details, not just population, because this is not something that can be determined only based on population. It's based on the need and the capacity for a community to serve clients, even if they only have a small number. But I'd be happy to bring more detailed information to you on how they're doing that.
Thank you.
Okay, Chair Carter, I'll talk a little bit about the family-based services. And the family-based services are services that the child welfare provides to families that have been impacted by abuse or neglect. And those services, to a great degree, assist us in providing reasonable efforts both to prevent the removal of children from their home or make efforts to return children back home. And those family-based services are the family sex abuse treatment, and that's a contracted service in communities for child victims of sex abuse or non-offending parents. Housekeeper services, very limited funding for this, but these services can be purchased if we have a parent that's medically compromised or has a need for short-term assistance in the home that would prevent the removal of their children. We have parent training services, of course, to assist the high-risk families that we work with in improving their capacity to safely parent children. Intensive family-based family services, those include family counseling services, and in more recent years, in the last 5 to 7 years, they've included to a greater degree the facilitation of family meetings. Intensive home-based services are contracts for very intensive home contact. We provide those in 14 counties, not in 36 counties like the others, and it's an important skill-building process that has providers available to families on an emergency basis, and they can carry a very limited number of cases. We have supportive remedial daycare, which has over the years been a very important service for families. This daycare service is not intended to support parents as they go to work, but it is instead intended to support parents as they relieve stress in their home or maybe seek treatment services and to support their ability to improve their parenting. The one final area of service provision that we have, our system of care flexible funds. You're probably aware of that discussion from previous years. And these flexible funds assist us in providing unique services to families as we identify their needs, and there are some services that we cannot contract for or families can't obtain on their own, and the flexible funds may assist us in creating a unique, generally their short-term contract for a service need that a family has.
Let me ask Ms. Foley a question. What is the status of the system of care agreement between DHS and General Rights Project?
A check card of that agreement is still in place, and it's signed by the Juvenile Rights Project and by Dr. Goldberg and I and the Department of Justice.
And how much money are we talking about?
We're talking about, Chair Carter, the agreement itself is not the same as the flex dollars. The flex dollars are part of our budget, and our flex dollars, as I recall, are about $8 million, Eric, for the biennium. And the agreement is closer to around, and I'm going by memory, I don't have it in front of me, about $200,000 in the agreement. And the agreement, what happens with Juvenile Rights Project is they actually monitor how we are doing the strengths-based model. Okay. Thank you. Chair Carter, it's $6,060,000. $6,060,509 in total system of care. And the Juvenile Rights Project agreement continues to monitor and make sure that across the state, all 36 counties are still using the strengths-based approach, that we are, in fact, using the least intrusive methods of engaging families, and they get quarterly reports from our offices about how those goals are being met.
So are there measurable outcomes for this funding?
Chair Carter, there are measurable outcomes, and I think we could get you a copy of the most recent evaluation.
Yeah, we would like to see that, because they should be showing us something different than what your outcomes were as a result of the lawsuit in the first place. And so I want to make sure that we have measurable outcomes that we can see within, you know, with $6,605,000, $60,500, we should see some measurable outcomes. So would you please make...
Sure, can we pull that information for you?
I'd appreciate that. Now, does this piece encompass domestic violence?
Chair Carter, the domestic violence piece might be a side piece of a system of care funding, but the system of care dollars are really more likely to be used to try to keep a child from coming into foster care or to try to achieve an outcome for a child who is in the foster care system. There's other funding available on the domestic violence side.
And maybe you can bring that to us, ladies, but I'd like to know the relationship between the numbers of dollars that you have in DHS, or what is the relationship between the numbers of dollars you have in DHS for domestic violence and the numbers of dollars that the Juvenile that the Justice Department has.
Okay.
Chair Carter, I'll try to respond to that question. I had Bonnie Brodigan give me some information before I left, so she's the person who oversees that grant fund. There tends to be some confusion between both the other piece of this is that TANF has some domestic violence funds, Child Welfare has some domestic violence grant funds, and the Department of Justice has some grant funds. And the grant funding that's administered by the Department of Justice Crime Victims Assistance section. Child Welfare and DOJ share the same providers, but neither side comes close to meeting the overall need for domestic violence services. They're in the process, as I spoke earlier, of doing an equity study to determine how funds should be allocated. And DOJ is currently asking for an increase in Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Fund, which is the only general fund of this service. And child welfare has grant funds that are federal funds, so they're different sources of the funding. They do share providers, and they do help assist each other in funding community access to these services.
So are we seeing an increase in domestic violence in the state as to why you don't have enough resources to take care of those, or what's the status?
Chair Carter, I can just say that, and I'll be happy to try and get you some more specific information, but domestic violence tends to be usually the second highest family stressor. I want to be sure that I get back. It's either the second or third in terms of families that are impacted by abuse, drugs and alcohol, generally the first, and domestic violence will fall somewhere in the first or second. Whether or not there's an increase in that kind of behavior, I don't want to speak without having that information right in front of me.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Morissette, please.
Thank you. I want to go back to the safety net that I guess there are grants to counties that identify children below the radar screen that serves children and families. Is that under domestic violence and sexual assault services?
Chair Carter, Senator Morissette, could you ask that question one more time? Were you wondering if safety net was under the domestic violence services?
Well, my bottom line is how much money is available for the safety net services. And I can't find the right category, I guess.
Chair Carter, Senator Morissette, just give me 1 second and I'll find my information on safety net. Okay.
Ms. Baker can help you, I think.
Okay. I hope. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, what used to be the community safety net used to be grants to counties to help deal with families who didn't meet the level of coming into the child welfare system but still needed risk. That money, I think we heard last week, that money has been redirected to more specifically focus on families that are receiving TANF cash assistance and other services to help those families. So the community safety net has been redirected and also relabeled to family supporting connections. And none of that money is per se targeted towards domestic violence, although that may have been a reason that the family comes into the system, but it's not available for grants out to communities the way that the domestic violence grants that Ms. Swanson is talking about is available to communities.
I guess I need to have a private conversation about this. Will you find something?
Chair Carter and Senator Morissette, we have approximately $1.5 million in the governor's recommended budget for family support and connections. We did do some research since we were last here and talked about this particular topic, and yours happens to be one county that has added additional funding. Multnomah has added additional funding. Clackamas, I don't have the whole list, but several counties have added money to family support and connections so that they not only serve a family who might be at risk of child protective services intervention for TANF families, but they serve other families as well. And so we have some details around the funding of that if you'd like to have that after this meeting.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Excuse me just for a moment. Earlier we recognized and welcome SEIU members, and for those that have come in since September, welcome. We also welcome our Citizens for STAND for Children who are in the Capitol J as well. So welcome and enjoy the hearing. Thank you, Ms. Foley.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, I'd like to now move through the Child Protective Services system, give you a brief description of screening and the assessment process, and then I'll identify some data that may be helpful to you. As Ramona Foley said, that we've been doing a lot of work over the last year and actually over the last probably 3 to 4 years in trying to improve our Child Protective Services response, and in the last year the safety intervention response of all of the child welfare system. The statute that covers the statute that applies to our work in Child Protective Services is 419B005 through 419B045. And child welfare, along with law enforcement, has a responsibility to receive and respond to reports of child abuse or neglect. If you would turn to page 92, I'm going to walk you through this funnel and then also describe our system as we go through that. So, in the year 2006, our child population 0 to 18 in Oregon was 872,280 children. In the year 2006, we received 60,746 reports of child abuse. 74% of those reports came from mandatory reporters. And legislators are mandatory reporters, doctors, teachers. I won't go through the entire list. So a good majority of the reports that we receive come from mandatory reporters. When we receive reports of child abuse, a screener, a social service specialist called a screener, goes through a process of determining whether or not the information is such that it includes information that the child is unsafe and child abuse or neglect is suspected. And if so, we would do a CPS assessment. If not, we may refer the family to another resource. We may provide some information to the caller, but we call that a close-it screening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your booklet that you gave us on page 19, it indicates 74% of children suffering child abuse or neglect suffer that at the hands of the mother or father. I'm just wondering if there isn't a conflict, because only 45% of the children are taken out of the home, yet 74% of the complaints involve either the mother or the father. Do you find that conflicting at all?
Chair Carter, Representative Girard, you're absolutely right. The most common perpetrators of abuse are mother or father, and the forms of abuse have a broad range. And when I talk about that, I'd like you to know that there are times when we assess a family situation and determine that abuse has occurred. The other kind of assessment that we're doing is determining whether or not the child can be safe at home. If there's any kind of service or safety process that we can put in place to keep that child within their home. There are kinds of abuse that occur that we can continue to have children at home and provide services to the family. It isn't necessary, nor would it be appropriate in every situation, to remove a child from their home situation, but I certainly understand your concern.
Thank you.
Further question? Senator Bates?
Can you give me an example of the kinds of things that you consider abuse or neglect for which you leave a child in the home?
Okay. Chair Carter, Senator Bates, we may find a situation where we have a parent that is dealing with a child. Maybe the child has behavioral problems, or maybe there are situational stressors. Maybe they've had a death in the family. The family's overwhelmed. The parents are overwhelmed, and the child is acting out, and they spank the child, and they leave injuries, or they slap the child, and they leave an injury. and the injury is abuse, but the family situation is such that the parents are remorseful, it's situational, there are services that we can provide to them to help them get through the crisis that they're in, and it wouldn't be necessary for us to remove the child from their care in order to serve that family. Or it may be a situation where this is the first time, it's an isolated event, and it's possible that there's a community service that could support that family. Chair Carter, I could also give another example of a family situation in which we would like to try to work with the family at home. The category of neglect is very broad, and sometimes when we find that children have been neglected, maybe there's been inadequate supervision, or the parent doesn't have a good understanding of their parenting duties, but it's not to the extent that we can't work with them in home, perhaps through one of the services that I talked about, intensive home-based services, where we provide the parent with a coach that can assist her in organizing her day and preparing meals, in understanding what it takes to supervise a two-year-old. Those would be a couple of examples.
Chair Carter, on page 13 of that same booklet that you have, The Status of the Child, this report actually comes out every year and will be due out near the end of April again, and we'll have all the 06 information in it. But when you look at that little pie chart, you see how many of the incidents in 05 were neglect or threat of harm. And those cases, as Una says, are quite often really good cases in terms of trying to get services into that home so the child doesn't have the trauma of having to be removed. We have a fairly high placement rate in this state in terms of children coming into foster care. And we'll talk a little bit later about the absence of some really timely services for families initially so that you could keep the child safely in the home. Many of these parents in the neglect and threat of harm are not intentionally harming their children. Many of these families, we talked about poverty all last week, many of these families live in poverty, and they struggle to be able to have the kinds of services that are necessary to meet the basic needs of their children. An example I was thinking of is the mom who might be working two or three jobs, and she's leaving her 6- and 4-year-old home with a sitter. The sitter doesn't show up. The neighbor notices this, calls this in, and says these children are unattended. That could be an issue around lack of supervision, and we have to go out and make sure that those children are safe. But it's not that the mom intentionally has left those children to be neglected. She's trying to do all she can to support the family, and her plan fell through on that day, and she didn't have a backup plan. So it's those kinds of cases that might come to our attention that we really try to work to keep that child safely within that family.
No, this is one of the conundrums you're up against. When you end parental rights, when you not end parental rights, when you're going to put a family back together, when it is a simple situation like you just described, or is it just the tip of the iceberg, and that you're not going to be there every day, 24/7, to see what's going on? A lot more could be going on. And while some of it's colored by my personal experiences of having kids in those situations, one of which died as a result of multiple calls to, at that time, a different name for agency. And it was something was going on. We couldn't stop it and couldn't get it recognized, and the child was killed. Those things do happen. You and I both know that. But it's a very difficult call. I just want to get kind of a flavor for it.
Sure,
the other thing that concerns me is we're seeing a continued escalation. I guess sometimes I ask myself, where are we? Look at all the reports on, are we getting anywhere? And we see child neglect and abuse every year going up. That much faster than our population. So we're not getting there for lots of reasons, most of which are nothing to do with you, but it concerns us.
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, you're correct in that the more reports each year, those reports have climbed. The increase this year is a slightly less of an increase than it was the year before, but it still represents a concern in the community that something's happening within this family that needs the attention of the Department of Human Services. And to Una's point, the importance of that screening is the screener's trying to determine from the report coming in, is there enough information here for me to know that this child is unsafe? And often the reporter only has a small amount of information. They don't know, as you indicated, all of the details behind what else is going on besides the child maybe being home alone. So that is one of the difficulties of that job of screening and child protection.
What was the mortality rate in upstate last year of children in foster home?
Chair Carter, we don't have the number of child abuse neglect fatalities calculated at this point. It takes some time to get completion of medical examiner records and police reports, but we will have that information in the next month.
Chair Carter, on page 14, we do have it for 2005, and that's the kind of table that we will insert for 2006. In this document, I'm sorry, it's in the status of the child document. It shows the child fatalities where abuse or neglect is suspected.
Thank you. It's on page 14 in the status of children.
Representative
Nathanson. Thank you. Is there a table in this booklet that you've handed us today, a chart that shows what percentage of these reports are the various factors? For example, failure to provide adequate food or medical care or some of the other categories. Do we see it broken down in that way?
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, on page 13, if you look down at the bottom, you'll see a pie chart, and it says incidents of child abuse or neglect. And this pie chart is for 2005. We'll have a very similar one for 2006. So you'll see in the area of neglect, that pie chart says 29%, and neglect includes lack of supervision and protection, lack of providing medical care. It includes exposing children to a hazardous environment. We've added some of the criteria around exposing children to a meth lab, that kind of thing, to the neglect area. Then on the other side of that pie chart, you'll see a number of areas identified as threat of harm, and you'll see that one of those areas is threat of harm neglect, and that will also include some situations having to do with supervision and meeting the basic needs of children.
Follow up, please.
Yes, please.
Thank you. It's the numbers within neglect that I'm interested in. How often is lack of food the concern or medical care? Can you provide those numbers so we can see what the worst factors are and what the greatest incidence is?
Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson, I'll take that question back to our researchers. When a worker found on neglect, and then when they identify a victim, they identify the victimization as lack of supervision or one of those other areas of neglect, and I'll have to take that question back and see if we can break it down that far for you. I'd be happy to do that.
Madam Chair, on page 28, you have a breakdown of children in foster care and some of the primary reasons why they are in foster care, which may answer some of Representative Nathanson's questions in that regard. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dr. Beeks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have any idea what the parents of these children are looking like from the point of view of what kind of childhood they came out of? Are they the results of abuse? Are they the results of foster care? Have you done any studies or looked to get an idea if we're just having a constant recycling of these families over and over and over again? Again, anecdotally, I see that all the time. I've been in the same community for 30 years, and I'm seeing third generation of abuse and neglect now. And, you know, I go back to my old story, the child's born. I can pretty well pick out and tell you at that time the child's born what the risk for that child is as far as abuse and neglect are. And I would offer that I'm 90% correct. It's a sad fact of life. So you have any idea what this looks like?
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, in the status of children from 2005, if you go to page 19, you'll see an area called the families. And with that area does speak to the issue that you're talking about to some degree. Of course, we see the percentage, the makeup of who the perpetrator is by relationship. And then if you turn to page 20 in that same document, you'll see family stress factors. And this is the way in which we gather data, but what I'd like you to know is this is based on questions that the CPS assessment worker is asking over the course of the assessment, and certainly parental history of abuse as a child commonly comes up in that assessment criteria. You'll notice that the suspected drug and alcohol abuse is up at the top, the parental involvement with law enforcement and domestic violence are all up in the top of those stress factors. But we do have a series of questions that caseworkers ask that get at those issues, and it's not uncommon at all to have generational issues related to abuse and neglect or related to substance abuse.
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, this is a self-disclosure kind of question, and so some individuals are comfortable talking about the family history, others aren't. We haven't researched that here in Oregon, but nationally that is subject of some research as to what are the patterns of families who become known to Child Protective Services and whether or not there's family history and so forth. So we could make some of that available.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, sorry, Senator Worthy.
Thank you. In addition to that information, it would be helpful to know, to better understand how aggressive are your efforts to work within the identified family and extended family members. How aggressive are our efforts to find a family member who could step in, or even become that quote foster parent? What does that look like today? What are we learning from our experience? And then I recently had the opportunity to sit with Mickey Lansing and Iris Bell from the Commission on Children. They have a videotape that you may have seen. It's from a 60 Minutes show of a few months ago, and the story was about efforts to find family members, to find extended family members, and to keep children intact inside their own families. You may be familiar with the video that I'm struggling to recall, but again, we'd like to better understand what our efforts look like today. And I asked the question also, just reminded that our Chair Carter has looked at this issue and been working on this issue for a very long time, especially as it relates to keeping African American families or keeping African American children intact with family, extended family. I think you get the gist of what I'm asking.
Chair Carter and Senator Gorley, yes, we are familiar with the Reconnecting Families effort. Kevin Campbell, who's a gentleman out of Washington State, began that and reconnected a number of children in Washington State, and then his greatest success was probably in the state of Illinois, where young children, a lot of African-American children, were in the foster care system, had become totally disconnected from their family connections, and he was able to go through a process of connecting those children. Those children were on the verge of exiting foster care and really had no kin, had no relationships with family members. He's done some very impressive work, and we are working with Mickey Lansing and the Commission towards that kind of project. Your original question having to do with how successful are we at finding families for children entering care, tomorrow we'll share those statistics. We're basically about 30% of the children living in foster care right now are living with a relative, and that holds up pretty well when you look around the country. I think it's one of the things that Oregon has committed to over the years, maybe more so than other states. But that's something we can give you some more details on tomorrow when we talk about foster care.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Senator Bates. I'm just
the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon might have some of the information you're looking for. It's a great resource, and I've sent out a memo to all members just to alert you to the from April conference in Portland that will be coming up. It's a week-long conference, and I'm sure you're all over that too. But anyway, they do a lot of work in that area, and it'd be, I could put you in touch with them if you'd like. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair Carter, members of the committee, I'll continue going down this funnel where it's screening. The screening determinations are either close at screening or we would assign for face-to-face contact in the field. As Ramona Foley said earlier, we have two response times. Certainly as a part of our work with the National Resource Center, we've been working hard to increase or improve our timeliness of response. The response times are within 24 hours and within 5 days. For all of the assessments that were assigned for face-to-face contact, and in 2006, of all of those assessments, 8,017 ended in a founded disposition. The assessment process includes an assessment of whether or not the child is safe, a determination of the parent's protective capacity, and a determination of whether or not abuse or neglect occurred. And the dispositions in terms of whether or not abuse or neglect occurred are founded, which means there's reasonable cause to believe, and that threshold is lower than the juvenile court or the criminal court. It's a reasonable cause to believe, meaning a reasonable person could come to that same place. Then we have unable to determine and unfounded, and both of those are essentially, they're not founded. Unable to determine simply means there's some indication, but not reasonable cause to believe, and unfounded means there's not reasonable cause to believe that abuse or neglect occurred. We had an increase of 3.4% in founded dispositions over 05. The total number of child victims, and you'll see that there that we have 12,043 total victims, and that's a 10-year high. The unique count is the 12,043, and what the duplicated count means is that we may have had some children who were victimized more than once. Children removed from the home, we have 5,331 total removals and 6,712 who remained in home, and that's in terms of the assessment work that we did. I'd just like to let you know that not every child who was removed from home remains in substitute care, and sometimes they have returned home as well. 13.2% of the total protective service child abuse neglect reports are founded. And what that means is starting from the top, there were 60,000 plus reports. And as it made its way through the process and we moved from some were closed at screening, some went to assessment, and then of the overall total, 13.2% were founded. I'd like to move on now to the performance measure that applies to the Child Protective Services portion of the Department of Human Services. This is the measure for recurrence of child maltreatment. The purpose of this performance measure is essentially to evaluate the effectiveness of our safety intervention system. This measure will let us know how effective we are in assessing and determining whether child abuse occurred, and further in determining what kind of protection the child may need and developing an appropriate plan to provide that protection to keep them safe from further abuse. That is the measure of this performance measure. A state meets the national standard for this indicator if, of all children who were victims of substantiated or indicated abuse, founded abuse is the term we use in Oregon, during the period under review, then it's 6.1% or fewer children have had another founded report within 6 months. So if we have a child who's been victimized, founded for abuse, then there's a recurrence of maltreatment by this measure if there's another event of founded abuse within 6 months. I'd like to say that the state of Oregon has made good progress in this area in the last year. You'll see the graph at the bottom of your page, and you'll note that in 2006, we had 6.7%. Obviously, our goal would be that no child would be re-abused, but we do believe that some of the measures that we're taking around our safety intervention system approach are beginning to assist us in addressing the reoccurrence of the child abuse. Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm pleased to see the reduction in the re-abuse rate. It had been going up. And as you know, we're trying to meet a national standard. It's one of our reviews with the federal government. Could you get a little more specific on what you think you're doing specifically to reduce the re-abuse rate? Because that's a tremendous turnaround. And I'd love to hear what you're doing and how we can sustain that with the department.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, we've been using a number of different strategies. One of them is in the context of an assessment, we've done some work with our field offices around identifying not just the issue that was reported to us when we went out to assess the abuse, and caseworkers certainly do a really good job of this, but sometimes we've gone out, we've identified that neglect is the issue, and in the course of that assessment, it may have come to our attention that there was a different kind of abuse, but we chose to handle that as a separate issue rather than handle that as a part of a comprehensive CPS assessment and make a safety plan that addresses all the safety needs of the child and not compartmentalize those kinds of abuse. So I hope that makes sense. The other thing that we're doing, especially with the implementation of the safety intervention model, is we're focusing on those situations when we finish our assessment. I think you heard that there are three things that we do in that assessment process. We determine whether abuse or neglect occurred. We look at the protective capacity of the parent. And in the end, our final decision is whether or not that child is safe. And that's the place where we've been focusing some efforts to say, what was the safety plan for that child? Did we close that assessment, as Senator Bates offered earlier? Did we close that assessment that was founded? And did we make some preliminary decision that the family was safe to care for that child? Did we look at that carefully enough? In the other situation, if we had the case open for services, are we providing services appropriate to the need of the family? Have we determined what it is the family needs in order to increase their capacity around the protection of the children? So those are some of the areas that we're focusing on.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Gordon, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. Your response leads me to ask this question. I'm thinking about what is the safety plan for communities, whole communities. I'm thinking about those counties that are about to lose timber payments. And so how are we looking at strategies to plan, intervene? We're going to be looking at unemployment, a lot of stress on families, all those conditions that can lead to abuse and domestic violence, all those factors. can come to life in this circumstance. How are you looking at that? How are you talking about it within the department? How are we planning?
Chair Carter and Senator Gorley, there's some work happening at the cabinet level and at Dr. Goldberg's level, headed up primarily with public health, looking at what the impact of the loss of the timber money will be across the department. CAF, for the most part, delivers its services not through contract, but most of our services are delivered in the counties by staff. I think your question is an excellent question, though, in terms of any kind of prevention, what will happen in those communities, and I would rely on a partnership with Mickey Lansing and the Commission on Children and Families that do a lot of that front-end work, that preventive kind of work, and that might be something that we could talk with her before she comes for testimony, because I do think it has implications for us. Now, certainly the cases here are cases that are already known to us, and they will be exacerbated by the fact that if the parent loses a job or if there's no money in that home, and I don't think that we at this point have the total remedy for what that's going to look like from those counties. If everything plays out as it would in a textbook, we would have more reports coming in from those particular counties as those families face some of those situations in that community.
Thank you. Representative
Nathanson. Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a statement in the booklet, DHS remains committed, et cetera, et cetera. The practice emphasizes keeping children in their immediate families and with extended relatives. I think this is a great performance measure. I'm wondering if there's another performance measure somewhere else that keeps track of how often you are able to work with a family to keep the child in the home when the situation is appropriate. And one of the reasons why I realized I wanted to ask you about that is on page 28 of that booklet, under removal reason, I see that the situation is looking like it's deteriorating a little bit. Number of entrants is increasing where there has been parental drug abuse, parental alcohol abuse, child's behavior was a problem, et cetera. But I noticed that there are probably statistically significant reductions. In other words, not just minor one-year variations here. In inability to cope and child's disability, both of those went down in a significant way. And I'm wondering if that's something in your department's best practices or something that's happening out in the field that's helping those numbers to see reductions.
Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson, that's an excellent question, and if we could, we may hold that to the foster care presentation tomorrow and talk a little bit about those reasons. Well, I'd love to step up and take credit that something wonderful is happening. I'm not so naive as to do that, because this kind of yearly reporting, sometimes one or two numbers can change a percentage, and so I wouldn't want to sign up immediately that there's something extraordinary happening at that frontline level. But one of the things we will talk about tomorrow is a slight decrease now in the number of children having to come into foster care, and that's for the 2006. We are exploring that a little bit, assessing to see, because with the trend still upward in child protective services, you would think the trend would continue to follow in foster care. And it's not a huge drop, but it's some leveling off. We know some of that has to do, and we'll talk about this when we talk about forecasting on the 28th, some has to do with the methamphetamine issue and how aggressive the state has gone about trying to find those places that manufacturing meth. And during that period of time, that year, when those arrests were being made in communities, we saw volumes of children coming into foster care. Some of that has leveled off a little bit, so we still are concerned about the increase in child protective services, but tomorrow we can talk a little bit more about this particular table and how that influences children coming into care.
How much more do you have before you finish?
Chair Carter, I can very quickly go through the quality and efficiency improvements and the budget drivers.
That's all. What I'm thinking about is that actually we could read this piece, but if there were other questions on this issue that you would like to have, we actually only have about 3 minutes and left. So do you have, we can read the quality and but is there anything else you need to finish before that?
Chair
Chair Carter, I'd just like to just very briefly touch on one of the budget drivers that I think is worth noting.
Right.
And I'd just like to, we've mentioned several times during this presentation the impact of substance abuse on the families that we work with, and I think it is worth noting again that, just real briefly, in 2000, the alcohol and drug treatment capacity enabled 75% of child welfare parents with addiction problems to enter treatment. After some treatment reductions, that dropped significantly, so that in 2005, only 50% of child welfare parents needing addiction treatment could actually get into treatment. And just wanted to reinforce again the impact of that particular problem on our communities, not just on child welfare.
And Chair Carter, that will become very important whenever you hear from Bob Nichols' staff later in this process, because he's going to talk about some funding that would set a priority for child welfare families and some of the TANF parents who were trying to intervene earlier where there are drug addiction problems, and that will come forward as a policy package for that division.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that's an exciting policy option package. Has DHS, has your office predicted how many more parents will be covered if we have that additional funding in A&D services?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, that is part of that policy package, and so we can bring, I think the Bob can bring that information and we can provide that.
Great, thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you so much for a job well done.
Thank you.
Committee dismissed.